And right now we're in Alvin's house. What we think is probably about a 1970s home, tri-level, next to a green belt. That was about the time that those homes were really popular. And Mr. Jethridge, you were talking about those tri-levels and the extra load the foundation has during the break. I'm going to
absolutely
have you.
You can have 2-3 times the normal foundation load on a multi-level home, and all that extra weight on soil that if it's compressible when it gets wet, you'll get that much more settlement. And then Bob was making the note that if there's a basement, frequently the basement backfill for those walls is not adequately compacted. If there's a footing anywhere near that backfill, it can settle that much more with the extra load from the upper stories on it.
So what is the best practice for a quality backfill?
Well, you should always backfill in layers, but I can tell you that
ain't nobody got time for that.
Yeah. I can tell you that even if they do a really good job of backfilling, if they compact it to 100%, they're still going to still have some settlement with it. You should never put a footing on backfill material.
That's my when I write a geotech investigation, I say, you know, maybe a foot or two, but no more than that.
Right.
If we're building on the sides of the mountains where there's large deep fills, 10, 15 feet of fill, we'll extend those footings all the way through that fill to get down into the native rock or soils to limit the future settlements.
Because it's a lot, it seems like, you know, a lot of added expense up front, but done right, you're going to save a lot of money because you think the infrastructure is expensive. Try a repair.
Right. I mean, I'm continually amazed by people who build custom homes and won't spend $3,000 for a geotech investigation. It's like you're building, you know, $1 million home, and you don't think it's a good idea to protect it with $3,000 of information to make sure your house is built on the right soil. It just amazes me.
Or even if, you know, we're going to build it here and it's bad soil, well, then you change how it's built.
Right. You can accommodate for it once you know about it. That's right.
So let's just assume that we're going to assume a couple different things just to hear the process to educate the listener. Let's assume that he's in a situation, Alvin, in this tri-level home where he's got a settling problem. How do you deal with that far underground?
Well, usually when you have a settlement problem, you want to bypass those soils with some sort of a structural element like a helical pile or a micro pile or a push pile. Those are usually the instruments of choice for stabilizing a footing. And you drive those down past the soft soils until they lock up into the really hard soils. And then you lift the house up and stabilize it with those and leave them in place, basically.
And it's I shouldn't say fun, because nobody wants to deal with these kind of problems. But it is fun to see because it's all done at once. So the whole house will get lined up or the whole affected area. You're not doing it one pile at a time. You get them all set and it's hydraulically lifted at the same time.
Correct.
And then, so once it's lifted, we have a void. Do we just leave that void?
No, we typically will either mud jack or polyfill underneath the slab to fill that void that's kind of right next to the foundation there and kind of tie it in with the footing a little bit.
And then those piles are then just buried there in the soil and left to stabilize
forever.
The home forever.
Correct.
Forever.
Yeah, they'll outlast the house.
And what's really cool is when you're raising the house, if you've got significant damage on the inside, if the doors are racked, you've got cracks in the drywall, you raise this house and you see these cracks close up and the doors, you know, get level, and that's really neat.
And instantly you just feel better. I mean, yeah. It's like all that stress, it's a stress crack. All that stress is just gone.
Right. That's right.
And so that's in a settle. What if this is a heaving situation that he's dealing with?
Well, first of all, you have to identify it correctly, and that's easier said than done. You can easily maybe have a whole segment to talk about that. But if you discover that you have heave, then the best thing to do is to try to remove water the best way you can. Now, you can do that with gutters and drainage. Those are good things to do. But those are going to remove water around the perimeter, and many times the water's already accumulated in the middle. So now that's why Dave and I worked long and hard to develop the moisture level system that basically removes water where it's got its highest concentration in the middle of the house.
And you're much deeper in the soil on a tri-level home than obviously something built on top of the soil. Does that add any complications because of the thermal, being 6 feet underground as opposed to 6 inches?
It changes a few dynamics. You'll probably get less water down deep like that. But on the other hand, you've removed overburden. So if you have clays that are down there and you've removed overburden, now those clays want to expand up. So it does change a few dynamics. You just, it would treat it the same way, but...
And talk through how the system for heave that you've kind of engineered here works.
Right. So what we did is we set up a vacuum system that creates a sub-slab depressurization system under the slab. And we core a hole in the slab and run a 4-inch riser up through the attic where a vacuum is, and it pulls air out of that ABC layer that's under the slab. And then it brings dry air from the perimeter in. And that process of bringing dry air through dries out the clays that are underneath the ABC layer. And those clays, once they get dried out, then they can't heave anymore. And then sometimes they shrink.
And the moisture source could be, you know, a underground stream that's, or a river that's...
I would love to talk about that for just a minute.
Sure.
There are so many different sources of moisture. When you talk about the underground stream, up in the Troon area in North Scottsdale, you've got maybe 10, 15 feet of decomposed granites over solid granite rock. When we go through one of our wet El Nino-type winters where there's a lot of rain in December, January, February, you get so much water that falls right through the decomposed granites, hits that granite layer, solid granite, and then moves down, and there's so much moisture in there, and it's every 10 years when you have an El Nino. But that moisture, like you said, it's an underground river. If there's basements, it'll flow into basements there. They've never seen it for the last 10 years, but all of a sudden, here's all this water. So it's periodic water. Other sources of moisture, I don't know if you've walked around the perimeter of your house in August and September, but your air conditioner is sucking out 100, 200 gallons of water a month and dumping it right at your perimeter of your home, typically. You don't want that water to be there, but that's a source of water. You need to move that away from your house. For the listeners, do that. Extend the drip condensates away from your house so that you're not dumping all that water right on your footing. And probably the next biggest thing
is... How far? 6 inches, 12 inches, 10 feet.
Move it 10 feet away. Cost you about $15. Put a little 3/4-inch PVC pipe, route it underneath, bring it back up, drip it. I use it to water my tortoise. I've got a little tortoise watering hole. But get it away from the house. It'll help with termites also because termites need that water. You don't need to be depositing that water right on the perimeter of the house. Underground irrigation valve boxes, those plastic things that they bury 2 feet away from your footing. Those things, if they're not leaking now, they're going to leak. Spend $200-$300, move those 10, 15 feet away from the perimeter of your house. That will, when they start leaking, they'll wet a 30-foot radius. It'll go halfway into your house. It's just a disaster waiting to happen. Move those things away to give yourself a chance to have drier soils underneath the house.
It's fascinating. When you think about that, every 15 years, back to what you were saying, and the underground, what's underneath the soil that goes down there? It's a fascinating world that's underneath our feet. And the amount of, you had mentioned termites, what is it, every, an average of 14 colonies per acre, they estimate, of termites that are out there in the native soil, that, you know, we only create conditions for them to thrive on when we slap a stick and stucco house right on top of their colony.
Right.
And a termite has to return to the ground every 24 hours to get a drink of water. So if you remove that drink of water, the termite's going to say, gosh, I'm going to go somewhere
another
else.
Source of water.
Right. There's other sources of moisture. I mean, just the fact that you have clay suction, you have rains that happen, poor drainage. It soaks down in the soil. You have dry clays in the middle. The moisture is pulled in towards those dry clays and accumulates. You have heat differential. You have very hot outside, very cool inside. The moisture sucks towards that. And then you have what they call the stack effect, where you have dry air that moves up through and up to the attic of the house and gets sucked in down below, and that's how radon gets into houses. That brings water vapor, too. But when the water vapor reaches the center of the house and it cools off, it condenses, And basically now it can't go through, so it's deposited right in the middle. There's lots of sources of moisture that get into houses.
And radon's one. It's been a while since we've covered that on the air with you, but just spend a moment on radon, because that,
sure,
that's a fascinating topic in and of itself. We could designate a whole other hour to.
Oh, you really could. I mean, radon is a radioactive gas that comes from the ultimate decay of uranium deep in the soil, and as it makes its way up, it gets trapped, and it's radioactive. If it gets in your lungs, it will cause lung cancer.
Well, and I would just add that granite rock is the local source of this radon gas. North Scottsdale, there's a lot of granite, and it's uranium decaying in that granite that produces the radon gas. And normal ventilation of a home will get rid of that, but if you've got a basement or if you've got rooms that the doors are closed and you're not getting good ventilation, that's where you're going to get accumulations of radon gas that can be a health concern.
And is there, we've got fire alarms, we have carbon monoxide alarms, or is there a radon alarm if you live in a heavy granite area like the Dells in Prescott or the boulders in Scottsdale or the foothills in Tucson?
There's a test that you run, and you run it for a day or two. You open a container. It'll absorb whatever the radon gas is, and then you send that somewhere to a place where they'll measure it, give you back a thing, and they'll tell you if you have unhealthful radon levels or not. I did a warehouse on 43rd Avenue and Indian School many years ago. There's no granted anywhere near it, but it had been closed for 2 years, and it had unhealthful levels of radon gas just because it was closed up. And the solution was open the doors and get some air in there, and a day or two later, it was fine. But you don't want to be working in these places with the unhealthful levels of radon.
Yeah, every home, every structure has its own aroma when you walk into it that, you know, after about the first 10, 15 seconds, you stop noticing it till you walk out and come back in. Is there something that should trigger your mind if you walk into it, you're like, oh, that's radon?
No, it's odorless. You can't see it. The only way to know is to test for it. And it's super cheap and easy. You can buy the kits for $15. You can get them for free from the state of Arizona, azrra.gov.
One more time,
A-Z-R-R-A.
A-Z-R-R-A.
.gov.
.gov.
And we have a continuous a monitor that we monitor the levels of radon through a continuous monitor that we install and leave on site, and it measures the levels over a period of time and gives a printout of it.
And what level is critical? I mean, is it a parts per million level that they're
right.
measuring?
4 picocuries per liter is the...
that's right, picocuries.
Yeah, picocuries. That's a billionth of a curie per liter of air. And that's the actionable level from the EPA. The World Health Organization says 2.7. So there's a little bit of difference there. But, I mean, it's kind of like splitting hairs. You get down to 4 and 2.7, you're probably good. You know, you want to avoid things like 11 or 12 or 15. That's where you run into problems.
And that's all solved just with ventilation?
Well, it's a subslab depressurization system, similar to what we use with the moisture level. You want to evacuate the air under the foundation.
Talking Foundation Solutions with Arizona Foundation Solutions.